interesting subject this morning, and one that is not often discussed because the reliable information that people like to have is simply not available. Therefore, we must think in terms of generalities, but we also have an interesting equation here because the situation with which we are originally involved has descended to us and been re-stamped in our present generation. In other words, most of the material dealing with the mysticism of Dante has come back into focus in the last 20 years. But to go back to the beginning of the subject, which is quite a fascinating one, we have to go back to the Crusades. And the Crusades, as you all know, were tragedies and disasters. The desperate effort to rescue the Holy Sepulchre from the hands of the infidel failed miserably. And wave after wave of European knighthood, the very cream of the aristocracy, the cultured, the educated people of their time, were involved in this hopeless expedition into the desert, and most of them left their bones there. In the meantime, at home, there was a strange change taking place due largely to the tragedy of the Crusades. Practically every important leader of European culture was somewhere in the Holy Land. Kings, princes, dukes, scholars, professors, priests, clergies, popes, all of these different levels were involved directly in the great effort to rescue the Holy Sepulchre. Perhaps the most pathetic of all of the great crusades was the Child's Crusade, in which thousands of children died in the sands of the Near East if they got that far. So it was a very pathetic period, and in this time, Europe was deprived of a very large part of its male leadership. Nearly everyone who was strong enough to bear arms was in the great crusades. And the entire internal life of many countries suddenly descended upon women. They were the ones who had to carry on. They not only had to carry on their private family lives, but they had to carry on the management of the state. They had to carry on the churches, the cathedrals, the palaces. They had to go on with all of the complications, the conspiracies of the time. They were suddenly forced to become the leaders of their domestic culture. For the most part, I think we can say they did an excellent job of it. But the most important of their contributions was that, as women, they were not much interested in war, except in a very unpleasant way. They were not interested in most of the ploys of power that we have become familiar with. They were much more interested in the arts. They were culture conscious. They had a deeper religious insight. They were more given to contemplative considerations. They preferred to fulfill the duties of motherhood. They were the mothers of kings and the mothers of princes. But most of all, as women, they were not basically militant. And their feelings were much emphasized by the fact that many of them, maybe most of them, lost the men in their family in the Crusades. So suddenly Europe was dominated by a powerful feminist culture. This culture, as Lord Clark points out, began to show itself in arts, in music, in drama, and largely in religion. The new emphasis, therefore, was not upon power, but upon the gentler emotions. Not so much upon conspiracies and invasions and battlements, but upon making a warmer environment for home. These women, whether it was in palace or cottage, were home builders. Gradually, the battlements of the castles were planted with flowers. Tapestries were added to the walls. Beautiful paintings appeared. And the cultures and graces were exemplified. Courtesies became more obvious. And the entire emotional life of the people received a very powerful impulse toward refinement. In this time, we have a great record of the arts of the period. We know that it was in this time that most of the great Christian art of Europe began to appear. It was at this time also that the cult of the Virgin Mary began to take a very definite form. In earlier times, it was passed over rather lightly. It was venerated but not emphasized. And all of a sudden, the cult of the Virgin came to be emphasized, to be considered as identical in motive, in ideal, and in conviction with the new spirit of gentility that was arising in the land. Also, we find quite a change in the artistry of religious paintings. The Madonnas began to look very motherly. They looked kindly. They were gentle and beautiful people. Whereas previously, in the Gothic forms, they were often very crude and firm and rather adamantine in their appearance. So the cult of the Virgin came into strong emphasis. Now, this was not completely new. It had happened before, although many people deny that there is any trace of it. The truth of the matter is that the worship of feminine deities goes back to the very beginning of time. The supreme deity, as far as public veneration was concerned in Egypt, was Isis, the mother of mysteries. In Greece, we have a whole group of feminine divinities, perhaps the most important of which was Athena, who was not only the goddess of women, but the goddess of war, the goddess of literature, of learning, and of arts and crafts. In Chaldea, Astarte, and in many other areas, the worship of the feminine principle was already well established. In Europe, however, it had not become dominant until women themselves began to cultivate the characteristics and qualities of feminine nature. Women became far more refined. They had more time on their hands with the local conditions held in suspension by the Crusades abroad. Embroidery, artistry, the education of their children came closer and closer to their lives. Their children were not educated as they had been by professional warriors. They were educated by their mothers, their aunts, their grandmothers, and by governesses. The whole change in cultural life in Europe began with the Crusades and the consequence of this particular circumstance. Now, of course, all the men did not perish en route, and some of the older and the younger never got to the Crusades. But this principle of gentility, this new refinement, reached into practically every phase of life. And about this time, there arose in Europe, particularly in Italy and Provence, province of France, the troubadours. Now, the troubadours we consider now to have been simply professional musicians. We know that they did go from castle to castle and from court to court, playing their melodies and reciting their heroic hymns and odes. Of course, among the troubadours were the ones who carried forward the great mythology of the Grail cycle, the great mysteries of King Arthur and his court, Charlemagne and his paladins, and all of the European legendary. But the troubadours came from a word, trouvier, meaning a priest. They were not simply secular musicians. They were actually banded together in a kind of mystic fraternity, which was very tightly tied in to the new situation that was developing in the social life of Europe. These troubadours became, therefore, the singers of romantic songs, the singers of love songs, the singers of the gallantries of the knights and the courtiers in the treatment of women. They were also much concerned with the famous rescue of women from tyrants and ogres, and the troubadours created and spearheaded the Age of Chivalry, in which knighthood was dedicated largely to the protection of the weak, to the liberation of those who are unjustly persecuted. And the knight errantry was almost a sacred art. And in these days, a young man, when he was knighted by his overlord or on the field of battle, retired into a church or cathedral, and there did vigil and prayed night after night that he might dedicate his arms and his life to the service of good, of truth, and of the helping of the afflicted. So that knighthood gradually also changed its focal point. Instead of going out to fight on the fields of battle, the knight became a champion of persecuted causes. He became a defender of the faith, the defender of the faithful, the protector of the widow and the fatherless. He was a dedicated person whose sword and his heart were dedicated to the service of those in need. Now, the knighthood and chivalry organizations also mingled with the troubadours. And the troubadours, together with these other organizations, created a very interesting situation, based undoubtedly, originally, upon disillusionment. The trouviers, the troubadours, were dedicated to what were called the courts of love. And these institutions are represented in ancient emblemism largely by a walled enclosure in the center of which grew a flowering rose. Now, this rose later became involved with the Rosicrucians. It became the rose of the House of Tudor. It became the rose of Martin Luther. The rose became the symbol of love, as it was simply an acrostic by arranging the letters differently. R-O-S-E became E-R-O-S, the word meaning love. So this particular situation, the courts of love, had a very interesting background. And I think the way to approach it is the way Dante approached it in his strange, mystical, psychic piece of poetry or example of work, The New Life. Here we have a key to something. The women who were meditating upon the state of Europe as it was handed to them when their men left realized that the whole social structure was wrong. Furthermore, they realized that there had to be a change, and a great many, in fact, most men agreed with them. Because, after all, there's no particular pleasure in going out and rotting in the fields of Palestine. It was far better to be home doing things that were constructive or interesting. So what happened was this. It became obvious to these people, symbolically, that the mind was associated distinctly and definitely with the male principle, and the heart with the feminine principle. And the whole point of the time was the gradual transference of leadership from the mind to the heart. The basic argument was almost irrefutable. All the conspiracies of state, all the selfishness, all the ambitions, all the corruptions, seemingly arose from bad thinking. The mind became a kind of tyrant. The mind became a destroyer of life. It invented one device after another to kill people. The mind was a separating force. It was a force that was constantly seeking self-aggrandizement. It was selfish, self-centered, and ambitious for possession and estate. It wanted wealth and power and would commit all kinds of crimes, including murder, to gain an office that it wanted. It was the mind that planned the stratagems of state. And in the days of the Medicis and the Borgias, the stratagems of state were not particularly ethical. Everything was based upon getting power, using power, and abusing power. This gradually dawned on the minds of those who had passed through the terror of the Crusades, which was one of the most terrible episodes in world history. And scarcely had the Crusades been assuaged when came the next great enemy, the Black Death, the bubonic plague, which for over 300 years ravished Europe. And it is said that before it was over, it had taken in death two-thirds of the population of Europe, man, woman, and child. Here was another great disaster, and the mind was unable to cope with it. The high professors of Avignon could do nothing in their universities to solve the mystery of the plague. They tried everything they could think of, from pleading to God to selling their soul to the devil, but the plague continued because they did not have the realization or the knowledge or the skill to realize that it was carried by rats. But the plague devastated the people left from the great crusade patterns, and Europe was in a terrible misery. It was in a desperate situation, and life became comparatively meaningless. Even the most powerful were not assured of a single extra day of life. To meet this problem, then, it became evident that something had to be done to change the basic attitudes of human beings. And the circumstances were propitious. The circumstances were made more obvious and set up as better examples by the leadership of women in the period following the Crusades. During this time, they gained ascendancy. And wherever they did gain ascendancy, things were better. They were very successful in maintaining concord rather than sacrificing life and liberty to discord. The troubadours, taking this motive, and followed by many other groups, all the great poets of the 14th and 15th and 16th centuries shared these convictions. Later, Goethe gives us the line, "The eternal feminine leads us on." And this was what happened in Europe. The eternal feminine became personified in the Virgin Mary. And the worship of the heart or love principle began to gain ascendancy. It was decided as important to shift rulership of the personal life from the mind to the heart. Well, the consequence of this effort resulted in a whole group of symbolic institutions and greatly strengthened mysticism in Christianity. Mysticism became the approach by means of love, the courts of love, the love of God, the love of man, the love of nature, the love of truth and of beauty. We come all the way back to Plotinus and his essay on the beautiful. This same spirit moved in Alexandria in the first century A.D. It is found in practically all ancient civilizations, but never brought to the same degree of focus as it reached in Europe. So the whole center of gravity, we will say, the hub upon which civilization was to turn, was taken from the rulership of the mind and bestowed upon the rulership of the heart. The heart, therefore, became not only the ruler of life, but the ruler of the mind. It was no longer subject to the mind, but the mind was under the censorship of the heart. And, of course, there was ample religious foundation for this point of view, because it fitted perfectly with the Sermon on the Mount, with the teachings of Christ, and with most of the mysticisms of the early church in their formative days. the whole idea of softness, of forgiveness, of charity, of unselfishness, all this was summarized in the cult of the Virgin, and also became the leading, we won't say fad, but the possessing fantasy of the time. It took over as a tremendous moral force. Now, in the development of this concept, there were certainly secret societies set up in Europe. Among these secret societies, probably the most important was the troubadours. And these included not only Dante and their membership, but also many other great poet mystics of their time. There's even reason to believe that the remnants of the troubadours survived in England and on the continent as late as the 17th or early 18th century. The Pléiade, the great constellation of poets under Ronsard, was part of the troubadours. They were the poets of great verse. They were the writers of the sonnets. And, of course, the amatory note of such sonnets as those of Shakespeare are all symbolical, relating to the mysterious damosel of Dante Gabriel Rossetti. The damosel was the heart, the soul, the secret love. It was that part of man's nature to which all the rest sacrificed itself. And the idea of the Virgin Mary gradually came to be bestowed upon the feminine sect completely. All women became personifications of the Virgin Mary and were so treated as symbolical respect for the Mother of Christ. Now this we find clearly set forth in Dante's work, in which he also gives another interesting and very significant modification of the concept. Dante's Beatrice was, of course, undoubtedly the symbol of his own heart and the soul which is within us and which is, more or less, the immediate vehicle of the heart. The soul is seated in the heart. The heart manifests through the soul. And the body is actually a kind of vehicle through which religion, ethics, culture, idealism, and integrity can express themselves. So to Dante and to the troubadours, there came another interesting twist in the belief, namely that the secret love must be something that no one knew anything about. The individual had to have a mysterious damosel whom he never discussed with anyone, and whom he never met. It was not a case of the refinement of personal relationships alone. It was the idea that the troubadour worshipped the feminine principle as the unknown woman. The woman whom he never met, Dante is said never to have seen Beatrice, except on one or two occasions at a distance. He never spoke to her. He knew nothing about her personally. He was not aware of her death until he learned of it. But through his entire life, she was the blessed, mysterious woman within himself, to whom he gave a complete allegiance, whose service he was dedicated to, who he would never perform a deed which would cast a reflection upon her. But he never met her. And this was part of the whole philosophy of the courts of love. They were not simply a refinement of physical relationships. They were a transcendency over them. And it has been suspected, and probably rightly, that St. Francis de Assis was a troubadour. They were the worshippers of the invisible woman, the mistress of life. And they created around her a code of fraternity and friendship to compete with and overwhelm the code of the mind with its forever destroying, its ever corrupting, its ever compromising. Now, there's no question in the world that this particular point of view did have an effect upon human relationships. It ennobled them considerably over previous conditions. And it brought a new respect, a new honor, and a new regard for the chastity of marriage and for all of the domestic relationships of life. But all of these were extensions and symbols based upon an immaculate relationship with life. The point now, I think, comes down into our present day with a certain amount of real significance. The Great Crusades were a tragedy in history. They resulted in the rise of this strange and very beautiful belief. The collapse of the Egyptian Empire led to the rise of Egyptian mysticism. The falling of Greece brought with it the revival of Greek mysticism. The collapse of Rome made way for the rise of Christian mysticism. In the Far East, it is the same. While in India, we have the male divinities, we also have forever the feminine divinities who become the symbols of human improvement. And of course, most of all in Buddhism, we have Kannon, the Bodhisattva of compassion. The principal belief of these people is compassion. And the embodiment of compassion began as a male divinity, Avalokiteshvara. But in a very short time, compassion was feminized. And throughout all of Asia, the Kannon, or feminine aspect, is the one that has received the love, devotion, attention, consideration, and worship of hundreds of millions of people. Therefore, the feminine principle truly leads us on. We are just passing through a great period of international world maladjustment. We are coming to a kind of situation which is not so different from the Crusades. We are not trying to rescue something from somewhere, but we are trying to save everything from the various adverse forces that operate upon it. We are working to protect our way of life. We are working to protect our governments, our nations, our industries. We are working to protect employment. We are working to find answers to the pressing problems of the day. And we have sat back and waited. And we have heard and listened to all kinds of remedies. There is scarcely a time you can turn on your television in which somebody does not make learned remarks about something. But after we have heard them all, we still find no answers. Everything is in terms and technologies. Everything is to try to bolster a way that has failed, and a way that we do not wish to admit has failed. We do not wish to admit the two world wars, a great depression, and incredible inflation in the present century means something more than a passing incident or a group of incidents. In other words, we're getting very close to the point that they were in at the time of the Crusades, when it became evident to the mystics and the troubadours and the mystics in the church that the time had come to shift leadership from the mind to the heart. That only in this way is there any hope of creating an integrity. The mind simply is incapable of placing the kindliness that is necessary, the sympathy, the understanding that we need. These are virtues of the heart. True friendship cannot be accomplished by treaties or legislations, but only by a fraternity arising within the emotional integrity of persons. We cannot bring peace out of the present chaos until we find some way to give love authority over conduct. The old mystics in the church were very certain of this. and in the symbols of alchemy, and the symbols of the Kabbalah and everything, these principles are clearly set forth, that the answer to the question is not to be found in skill alone, because skill is a tyrant unless love guides it. There is nothing that we need today that is not obtainable or attainable if our emotional integrity requires it. If we are willing to sacrifice for the common good, it is because we have affection for the common good. If we are willing to put the well-being of another person above our own, this is because we love either that other person, or we love the truth or the principles upon which conduct is based. The only solution for the broken home is true love. The only solution to the wayward children is true love. Love that is not contaminated by the ulterior motives of the mind, which has always been, as the Bhagavad Gita tells us, the slayer of the real. On the Crusades, it slayed millions in the deserts of Arabia and Palestine. In two world wars, it has slain millions. In the Great Depression, it is threatening the survival of nation after nation, even today, because there is no essential reverence for or veneration for the human being as a creature. We are not concerned sufficiently with the good of others that we will take the position that was taken by the troubadours in the effort to solve this problem. One thing that Dante points out, and his whole Vita Nuova is key to it, is that in the adoration of the Blessed Damozel, there is no requirement for compensation or recompense of any kind. It is too much to ask that she will even smile. It is love given because of love, and it is not dependent upon reward of any kind. It does not follow that if we love another person, they must love us. St. Francis makes this point very clear, that there is no demand. Love demands nothing and gives all. And in giving all and demanding nothing, it gains all. In the relation of nations, if love becomes a vital factor, we are not out to benefit from treaties. We are not out to juggle with profits. We are not willing or interested in asking favors for favors granted. These are the ulterior motives that have defeated us since the dawn of time. And these are the motives that are so clearly brought to our attention in Dante's book. Here we have the true way in which love operates. It operates without any hope or desire for reward. This was the reason why, in most instances, the woman in Dante's visions is not a human being. And if it is happening to be a human being, and if any troubadour found a lady of his affection, still, the principal was not a person. The person might be honored, and the principal might be transferred to a person under some conditions. But not the person was not the reality of it. The reality of it was that there was something somewhere that was so beautiful, so wonderful, so pure, so filled with understanding and insight, that it became the one being, the one person, the one thing in the whole world that understood us. And for this person, the individual dedicated all of himself, asking nothing but the right to worship, asking no favor, sending out no prayer for recompense, but simply offering self completely in homage to this divinely significant person. And in most instances, the person, if it was a real person, lived and died and never knew of this strange, mysterious love of the troubadour, because he never revealed it and never did anything to compromise her or himself. It was simply that in his life, this person to whom he felt a mysterious attachment had become the object of the perfection of his own nature. As we read carefully through the lines of this, we begin to realize that this person is also the human soul. The human soul is that part of us which we have never seen, for which we can give no name, but upon which we have bestowed an innumerable number of names. The soul is that part of the individual which is the savior of the life. And in most of the mystical systems of antiquity, the soul, or the anima, becomes the blessed damozel. It also, in a larger sense, is the anima, or activating soul, of Christianity. It is this soul power which is the invisible beauty, the eternal feminine, the power that is built up and has always been resembled, represented in feminine form. This soul, then, becomes the heroine of the story. And life is nothing but a dedication to the perfection of the soul. It means that the individual must give up every action, every thought, every attitude which conflicts with the integrity of his own soul. His own soul demands and accepts nothing except good. The soul is without any ulterior motive. The soul is without any pretense. And the soul offers no reward, actually, to the person, except the realization that it is the proper thing. The service of the soul, as Dante points out, therefore, is not an exceptional thing. It is not an heroic thing. It is not something for which we should be forever compensated. It is not something that justifies our belief that we are on our way to a heavenly state. It is simply the fact that obedience to the soul, the elevation of the labors of the soul above the mind and above the body, is natural. It is the normal course, and anything else is abnormal or subnormal. The individual who is right is normal. It is a mistake to say that normal means to share in the common delinquencies. We may say that persons with various degrees of sharing with their own mistakes belong to an average. The average person does one thing or does another thing. But average and normal are not synonyms. The average may be comparatively low, but the normal is higher than the average person has ever been able to reach. So the normal becomes the perfect acceptance of the pure love of the soul, and the bestowal of all love upon the soul and its labors. And all outside persons and objects that are desirable, that are worthy of our affection and worthy of our service and worthy of our sacrifice, are in some way aspects of our own soul power. The soul, therefore, is the mistress of life. It is the power by means of which we do all things well, whereas for the most part, up to the present, we have been doing them rather badly. In this point, then, Dante is very clear in his understanding. When you read his book, you also discover another phase of this question, and that is the forlorn aspect. Dante is forever forlorn. He is forever defeated. He is forever weeping. He is forever sorrowing because he has not been able to be worthy of his beloved. Some of this goes all the way back to the Song of Solomon in the Bible. The point, of course, in Dante's story is this sense of his own imperfection, No matter what he does is not good enough. No matter how he serves, he is not worthy of this ineffable beauty and ineffable goodness that he recognizes as his mistress. He is delinquent in many things. He is unable, for example, to attain a peace within himself that is sufficient to carry him through his longings and his hopes and his seekings after the invisible. He is therefore always so more or less frustrated. He is forever the prodigal son. He is forever the one who has to find his way back in some manner to the heavenly regions from which he came. He lives, therefore, in a state of constant emotional sorrow. Of course, Dante was a poet, and he was a poet with an extremely complicated nature. We know, for instance, that in the Divine Comedy, he is not only a great poet, but a cynic. He is a cynic and a skeptic. In the Divine Comedy, he caricatures his personal enemies, and he places in the lowest regions of perdition those persons whom he personally dislikes. He also was able to caricature many of the leaders of his time, which did not endear him to them, but fortunately he was able to escape from the normal retribution by becoming an exile. Also, he was a strangely emotional man. He had a strange intensity of sentiment. He was an unbridled sentimentalist.